Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host David Bell talks with the head of the Kansas City Office of the Missouri Public Defenders, Ruth Petch, about her efforts to get more resources, both human and monetary, for her office, the threat of public defenders losing their licenses to practice, and what the overload of cases means for their clients. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is David and his guest.
Good morning, this is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on KKFI. We have a special show today. My guest today is Ruth Petch. She is the district defender for the Kansas City area, and I'll have her describe her role in more detail in a second. And we're going to talk briefly about the foundation of the Public Defender's Office, why is it there, what its purpose is, and then we're going to go into the current crisis that's facing the Public Defender's Office, and frankly, a current crisis that's been ongoing for a number of years now, but is now appears to be coming to at least some type of a head and hopefully some type of resolution for indigent defendants. With that, we'll dive right in. Let me welcome to the show Ruth Petch. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And Ruth, if you could briefly describe who you are, your position with the public defender system, and then what is the public defender system, and particularly the Missouri State Public Defender System?
Well, I'm the district defender of the Kansas City Trial Office, so that means I'm responsible for running the Kansas City Trial Office. We cover all of Area 16, which is essentially Jackson County. And I have a variety of roles, most of them administrative. I hire, I fire, I make sure my attorneys are doing their jobs correctly. I make sure they're getting education, things along those lines. The public defender system is a statewide system. We were created in the 1980s. We are a subset, an independent subset of the judiciary branch of government. We were created because there was a need. There was a need for indigent people to be represented. So we were created. We have a group of commissioners that really hire the head of the system, and then the structure goes from there. So the Public Defender Commission hires the head of our system. The head of our system's name is Michael Barrett, and he really sets the structure from there.
So really briefly then, the public defender system, first of all, this is, we're talking about a state public defender system, is that right?
That's correct.
And so you're not legal aid?
I'm not legal aid.
Okay, and you're not the federal public defender's office?
No, I'm not.
So the Missouri State Public Defender System will take care of indigent defendants in Missouri state courts?
That is correct.
Okay, and what type of, and is it civil or criminal or just criminal?
It is largely criminal. We do have a unit that handles cases brought under the Missouri Sexually Violent Predator Law, which is a civil commitment statute, and the public defenders do handle those cases. But largely everything else is criminal.
Okay. And so what type of crimes are we talking about generally? What's the range from misdemeanor, misdemeanor DUI'd up to murder one?
Right. Not, my office handles non-death penalty murder one. We do have separate offices for death penalty work. But yes, everything from highway patrol tickets up to murder one cases.
And you mentioned the number 16 refers to your district. I do know that we're in the 16th Judicial Circuit in Missouri, meaning the 16th Circuit is all of Jackson County, including, we have Independence. We also have downtown. Is that your district?
Yes, that's right. So we handle cases that are filed both downtown and in Independence, as well as we handle the juvenile cases brought at the Family Justice Center.
And so the rest of Missouri is divided up into districts as well. Do those align up with the court districts, or do they sometimes approximate it?
Some do and some don't. Okay. I know there's been an effort to get those in line, but for the most part, there's a couple splits. But for the most part, some offices cover more than one judicial district, especially when you get out to more rural areas.
And so in terms of who runs the public defender's office from a statewide perspective, there's a director. Mm-hmm. Then you talked about a commission. So there's a group of individuals. Are those appointed by the governor, I assume?
Yes, they're appointed by the governor, and they serve volunteer terms.
Okay. And then who pays you? I guess. Is it the Missouri State Public Defender System pays you, but then where do they get their money from?
From the state of Missouri.
Okay. And you said, and so if you're, are you under the executive branch, the the governor or the legislative branch, the House or Senate, Missouri Senate, or the judiciary?
We're judiciary branch.
Okay.
We're supposed to be in this independent subset.
Okay. But somehow there's some type of oversight by the judiciary branch?
My understanding is that it's not supposed to be.
Not supposed to be. I'm sorry. It's independent. Okay. So we have that. Let's talk then about the number of cases that you handle, that your office handles in Jackson County. Could you give us some idea of the number of cases that are handled over a year period of time in Jackson County?
Well, I can tell you currently, I looked at our numbers, we have about 4,300 cases open. Now, some of those cases are in warrant status, but we have 4,300 open that we could be called to represent at any time. And I have 35 attorneys, including myself, to handle those cases.
All right. So a quick division there, that's about, what, over 100 cases per?
122. If you divide it by 35.
Okay. And so, but those cases can range all the way from, what, from misdemeanors up to the murder ones?
Correct.
We're talking about. Okay. And is there a, does the Missouri State Public Defender's Office handle a majority of the cases that come through the Jackson County criminal court system?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. All right. So let's then talk briefly about, and then we'll get to why we're here in terms of this, the kind of the ongoing crisis, which may be coming to a head. Why is it mandated, I guess, that individuals have representation in the criminal courts?
Well, that comes from the Sixth Amendment. You're entitled to have an attorney if you're facing a loss of liberty through our system. So that's the United States Constitution.
I've got this here, the Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
Correct.
Okay. And so I was researching this a little bit before we talked today, and it seemed to me that the assistance of counsel included a few various rights. One is the right to counsel of choice, at least that seems to be more for private attorneys, I think, or if individuals want to go hire their own counsel, they can hire whoever they want.
Definitely.
And then you have the right to appointed counsel, and then you have a right to conflict-free counsel. You have the right to represent yourself, but then the one I want to talk to about is the right to effective assistance of counsel, because that's really what we're going to get to today in a second. Does that sound right?
Yes. I would also argue that being overloaded creates a conflict among your clients, and we also would argue that a lot of our clients don't enjoy conflict-free counsel. And
we'll get to that. That's in a Rule 4, the ethical code for Missouri attorneys.
Yes.
But let's talk about what effective assistance of counsel, whether a right to conflict-free counsel or effective assistance of counsel, what we're talking about is what is the floor to which we're not permitted really to go beneath in terms of representing indigent defendants. And I'm trying to understand what that is, meaning, is it that every criminal defendant in Jackson County is entitled to the absolute best attorney out there? The one that they're going to devote their entire life, if you will, from the point of charge to the point of a trial to that client? Or is there something less than, and how do you define what that standard is?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's what we're struggling to come to terms with.
So I know in looking at this, and I've dealt with this before in my own practice as a criminal defense attorney, there's effective assistance of counsel has two prongs to it. So what happens is you go to trial. If you lose at trial, there's a direct appeal, and then there's something called a collateral appeal, which is essentially where you claim either if you pled guilty or if you went to trial that your counsel was ineffective. And there's two prongs to that. One is did the attorney's behavior or work during the case, did it meet some objective standard, I guess? Does that sound right so far?
Yes, it does.
And then the question is, all right, even if it didn't, even if it fell below what we all hope for this objective standard, did it actually prejudice the outcome of the case?
Right.
And so I know my own experience having litigated this, it's almost an impossible burden to meet, meaning to get a new trial almost based on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yes, I would agree. I think those of us in the criminal world would say it's a fairly low standard, or a number of us would.
And so, and I've got in here, it says the court concluded, and this is a Supreme Court case, the judicial scrutiny of counsel's performance must be highly deferential. Strategic choices are virtually unchallengeable, and reasonable decisions making investigation unnecessary are also unchallengeable. And so what I'm trying to understand is, from a perspective of a court reviewing this system to say, all right, was this handled fairly, whether by plea or by trial, you know, what is the backstop? Meaning, who's looking at it to say, all right, was this handled fairly? And on this one end, we're seeing that, at least from a litigation standpoint, if someone goes to trial and loses, or someone pleads guilty and they regret that decision later, a court oversight of that process, there doesn't seem to be any downside, if you will. Well, let me rephrase that. There doesn't seem to be, in reality, a court correcting that, an error in that system. Meaning, I don't see a lot of pleas or trials overturned for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, I would agree. Given the, if you look percentage-wise at the number of cases we trial and the number that come back on ineffective assistance of counsel, it's a fairly low number.
And I've got one quote here from McMahon versus Richardson, and then I want to ask a few questions about it. It said, the court observed that whether defense counsel provided adequate representation in advising a guilty plea depended not on whether a court would retrospectively consider his advice right or wrong, but, quote, on whether that advice was within the range of competence demanded of attorneys in criminal cases. And so I guess, Ruth, from this perspective, then who polices whether or not your attorneys are doing a good enough job, if you will, to meet a constitutional standard here?
Well, there isn't a lot of policing, at least, and especially for indigent defendants who don't have a lot of resources to make appeals. So for us, I mean, the judiciary, if a motion is filed, will look at ineffective assistance of counsel. And aside from that, you're talking about the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. But that's not, again, that's looking at how lawyers handle their cases, not how the specific case went. And it wouldn't necessarily bring relief in an underlying case if that's what you're looking at.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to see is that as someone passes through the system, what safeguards are in place to make sure that that person received the level of counsel that we as a society mandate as essential to be able to look back and say we have a fair and just system?
Well, that would be up to the judiciary.
All right. And so, but on this, at least on the ineffective side, if you're telling me, and I agree based on my own experience, you don't see a lot of these cases overturned for ineffective assistance of counsel. And
correct.
So then I'm trying to figure out what the standard is. And so let's move to the ethical rules of representation. If you could briefly describe at least some of the ethical rules that apply to lawyers and the representation of clients.
Well, so there's a number of rules that apply. We're a professional organization, and we agree to abide by these rules and keep up the high standards of lawyering. When you're dealing with clients, especially in the criminal defense realm, Rule 4 under the rules is sort of a guide. It talks about diligence, which I think is very important to a lot of our clients.
Let me read that. 4-1.3, a lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client.
Right. So, and I think in my office, at least with caseload issues, that's where we suffer the most. Again, reasonable promptness has, I guess you could define that a number of ways, but we really struggle to get cases worked up, to do investigation timely, and to have a person have a trial within a reasonable amount of time. To me, sitting in jail a year where you're not paying your bills and you're not able to live your life and communicate with your family is a significant burden on someone. And that's pretty much an average amount of time for us to get a case to trial.
So you're saying a year. And by the way, there was a case that I read about, I think you spoke in the article, about a 22-year-old man that was arrested for robbery. That, can you tell us what happened? He sat in jail for how long, and what was the result?
Well, 14 months, and he ended up pleading to stealing a fountain drink from Quick Trip. And he was charged with an armed robbery of a tourist from out of town at a hotel. And it turned out that there's no way it physically could have happened, that the distance, the time, when you looked at the times from the 911 call to the times on the video at the Quick Trip, that he physically couldn't have driven or run that distance. So he sat in jail a significant amount of time. And the case wasn't resolved until the day of trial, which is sadly pretty typical of how things run.
So let's talk about that case for a second. We don't have to get into the name of the individual. Obviously, it wound up resolving itself much better than certain prison time. It would sound like if it was an armed robbery with an armed criminal action, it wound up probably as a misdemeanor, it sounded like, potentially, or something.
Right.
Much lower. So what happens? Someone sits in jail. First of all, I guess they go before the Associate Circuit Court. They're told what they're charged with. They're given a bond.
Right.
And usually what? A bond in a case like that could be thousands or tens of thousands of dollars?
Yeah, I'd say probably in the neighborhood of $50,000, or 20 to 50, something like that. I can't speak to what the actual bond is in this case, but
generally speaking,
on a robbery in the first degree, that is what you're looking at.
And so if they can't make bond, then they're going to physically sit in the jail until the case gets resolved, or until the bond's lowered.
Yes.
Okay. In this case, it was 14 months.
Correct.
So I guess my first question is, why did it take 14 months then for, well, let me stop there. How was the attorney assigned to that case to start looking into it? When would that attorney normally have looked into it, and why did it take so long?
Well, the attorney would have been assigned pretty early on, mm-hmm. probably within a week of us finding out that we screen every client. So we go over physically, meet with them, you can't be represented by the public defender unless you're indigent. So you have to be poor enough to be represented by our office. So, and that involves filling out paperwork. We open the file and then we generally assign it within a week of meeting with someone in custody. So it would have been assigned early on. You would have had several court settings in the associate courts. This person would have been indicted unless we waive prelim. In general, we don't waive prelim unless there's a reason to, and it doesn't sound like there was in this case. And then it becomes some part of someone's caseload. The problem with the excess caseload that we have is that people have 100 people on their caseloads. And in general, they've been representing people for years. So they have trials set basically on a weekly basis. So you sort of join the queue of cases that this particular attorney has. And I find this attorney didn't do anything different than the situation most of my attorneys are in. And they're working up the trials that are coming up. There are trial settings, and they need to be prepared for those. So they may be doing some investigation. They may be hopefully visiting the clients, but they really will struggle to do deep investigation until it gets closer to trial, just because they're so overloaded and they're working on so many other cases.
So what you're saying is that if you were to assign me that case today, my first thought is not going to be that case. My first thought is the 99 other cases that are ahead of that case. And in particular, those cases are coming up for trial next week, 2 weeks down the road, a month down the road, 2 months down the road. It's just he's going to have to sit and wait for me to get to it. Would that be?
In general, yes.
Okay. And so assuming I am going to perform to whatever standard we decide is correct, me doing it in the right way, that he's going to have to wait for me to do it in the right way. Otherwise, he's going to get something less than the right way, presumably.
Correct.
Let's look at another one of the rules, competence, 4-1.1. A lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Competent representation requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. So in this case, we're just generally, or well, in this case particularly, I guess coming up with the amount of time to adequately prepare for the representation, that's the difficult part we're talking about?
Yes, that's definitely difficult, especially when you have 100 cases and you're trying to prepare all these other cases at the same time. You don't have the time to sit down and work on a case. And again, there's this reasonableness of the time, and that is where people really suffer.
But Ruth, let me ask you this. Most cases, in my experience, plea out, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and so if that's the case, then why isn't there a desire to get these done quickly and move them on so that we can focus on the trial counsel? Or is that the wrong way of looking at it?
Well, I don't know how you pick and choose what is the trial case. I don't know how you pick and choose. You read a probable cause statement, you know, a judge has read it, has issued an arrest warrant. Several people have looked at this document by the time it comes to us. So I don't know that magic filter that says these are the cases that I should quickly plead and these are the cases that I should move to trial. And several people have offered suggestions. But in addition, even if you're looking at a plea on a case, we're talking about what is a fair and just plea, because oftentimes the first offer isn't what's fair or just. And I know for me, representing poor people, I want them to get the same kind of plea deal someone would get if they hired your firm, David, that that poor people aren't treated under a different standard than people who can afford lawyers themselves.
And so what you're saying here, and I like that point, is that there seems to be no matter what the case, and obviously no matter who the client is, there seems to be a minimum amount of time that's required for every case in order to get to a point where decisions can at least start to be made. I mean, you talked about this, you don't know the magic filter. Well, on this case that was the armed robbery that wound up being stealing a Coke or whatever, Judge read a probable cause statement that said armed robbery, signed off on a warrant for the armed robbery. A detective had to look at it, a prosecutor had to look at it, all these people are looking at it. And so if we just read the probable cause statement and said, well, this guy's good for it, let me kick out the ACA, which is a minimum of 3 years in prison, maybe get him probation. Now we've marked him as a felon. That kind of quick thinking in this case could have resulted in serious consequences and really the wrong result, if you will.
Right. Well, to me, a complete miscarriage of justice, because he clearly is not the person that robbed that individual. And that person still walks the streets. If you're worried about if we as a community say, I don't want to have people who rob people in our community, that person is potentially still out there because they arrested the wrong man and closed that case.
So let's move one more rule 4-1.7. And again, to the listeners, as I've always recommended to people, go check out the Sixth Amendment. Go check out Gideon v. Wainwright. Go check out cases that talk about effective or ineffective assistance of counsel so you can learn yourself a little bit more here. Well, this says a lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. A concurrent conflict of interest exists if the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client, or there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. I got to tell you, Ruth, I see this rule and I think to myself, well, I can't represent two people that are accused of robbing a store together. That's a conflict. One may want to tell on the other one. One may say it wasn't me. One may say the other guy did something. But yet you're seeking to apply this to the Missouri State Public Defender System in the current crisis. How is that?
Well, if you are unable to take on representation and meet your duties to diligence, to competence, you're creating a conflict for your current clients. So if I have 50 clients, which most of my lawyers have double that, and I'm at capacity, my days are full, I don't have enough hours in the day to investigate any other cases. If I then agree to take another client, I've created a conflict for all 50 of my clients, because now I'm at an overload and I'm not able to represent any of them well. And that for us is a major problem, that it's physically impossible to represent the number of clients we represent. I don't know a single lawyer in private practice who says, I'm going to represent, 120 felonies. It can't be done. And it can't be done competently. There's probably a number of lawyers that run tickets through, but we're also in Jackson County. So we have very few misdemeanors. I have attorneys with 6 open murder cases, in addition to 60 other felony cases. I don't know how many murder cases you have open, David, but I'm guessing it's not 6.
Right.
And I'm guessing you don't have, 50 or 60 other felonies in addition to that. Serious felonies take serious consideration. We have so many things to look at. We have a lot of video. If you're looking at any of the forensic evidence, there's all kind. We have cell towers. We have ShotSpotter. There's a lot of technology that people are excited about that to help solve crimes. However, on the defense end, we are having to get it from ground zero and work it up, and it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort.
So, Okay, but forget the personal desire of an individual attorney to want to do the best he or she can. Just in terms of kind of the systemic kind of scrutiny, what's the concern from an individual attorney standpoint if a judge never finds that attorney ineffective moving forward in a case? Let's say I go to trial, I plead someone, I don't do the job I should have done. Obviously, that's a moral problem for me. Okay, but what is it that's come about that creates the problem now? Because as you've indicated before and in my own experience, a judge is not going to find me, generally speaking, ineffective, other than in the most extreme cases. So what's the problem then?
Well, the problem would be that you still are susceptible to having issues with your license. That under Rule 4, there's how you represent someone in the case in chief, but you could still have clients file a bar complaint against you, and you could still ineffective assistance of counsel, as I mentioned, is a much lower standard than the standards that the Missouri bar holds for its lawyers. And if there's a complaint against your license that you haven't been seeing your clients, that you didn't work up the case in a timely manner, all of these things that are direct result of being overloaded, you could have your license suspended.
And so what we're saying is that the ineffective assistance of counsel is the floor, if you will. You can't go below that, but that's a pretty low floor because it's not enforced that often. But you're saying that, and we're going to get to this as we move in the next half of the show, there has now been a push to potentially suspend attorneys for not meeting the higher standard, which are the rules of professional conduct. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
And that's the Hinkbine decision?
Yes. Well, that's it. That's what has come up recently involving public defenders and caseload, and has sort of really made public defenders nervous.
All right. When we get back, we'll speak with our guest, Ruth Petch. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Now, the calendar for November 6th. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, November 6th, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. For more information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, November 7th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, November 11th, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library. That's 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and needs advice and support, MIST has members that may be able to help. State Representative Brandon Ellington is again hosting the annual basketball tournament to feed the hungry, and Voices of the People are hosting the 11th annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner. The basketball tournament is to help provide food and giveaway items for the Community Thanksgiving Dinner and will be held Wednesday, November 15th at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. Team signups start at 5 p.m. and the games start at 6 p.m. Registration is one frozen turkey per player. Admission to the game is at least four canned goods or one frozen turkey or slightly used or new clothing or toys. The 11th Annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner will be held Wednesday, November 22nd from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. All are welcome to attend. If you would like to volunteer to help with either of these events, you can contact Representative Ellington's office at 573-751-3129 or email at brandon.ellington@house.mo.gov. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now, back to David and his guest, Ruth Pett.
Good morning. You're listening to David Bell on Jaws of Justice, 90.1 KKFI. I'm here today with Ruth Petch. She is the district defender for the Missouri State Public Defender System in the 16th Circuit. We've been talking about some of the kind of recent developments with the Public Defender's Office. We've all heard about being overworked, too many cases, not enough time. In the past, what we've seen is courts have been hesitant to find attorneys ineffective, generally because, and I don't know if we mentioned this, because it usually means the defendant's going to get a new trial, and the system probably doesn't want to go through that again. So now we've got another situation where we've got Missouri ethical rules, and we have individual attorneys that are being subjected to those and possibly having some impact on their license. When we took the break, we had started talking about Hinkbein, H-I-N-K-B-E-I-N. Before we go into that, I will say we will take calls on this subject, not about individual cases, but on this subject in particular at 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Ruth, let's talk about Missouri ethical rules and this focus, if you will, on the licenses of individual public defenders with the Hinkbein case. What is that case about?
Well, that case, and again, I only know as much as anyone who could read the Hinkbein decision, but you had a public defender who was falling behind. He was an appellate public defender. In appeals, there's some pretty firm deadlines, and some of those were missed. This attorney had some health problems, and then also argued to the Missouri Supreme Court that he was a public defender and his caseload was too high. And the judge made it pretty clear that public defenders aren't going to be treated differently. And I'll tell you, I don't want to be treated differently ethically than any other lawyer. I want to be held to the same standards. I think poor people deserve just as good a lawyer, just as ethical a lawyer as anyone else. However, in this case, because of the high caseloads, he was told that he should either have told his supervisor he couldn't take more cases or he should quit. And you could imagine how that rung around the halls of a public defender office.
So what we've got a situation here is we've got these ethical guidelines of really where we should strive to be at for terms of representing any client, okay? And what this case was saying, that the question for this case was, all right, when you have too many cases and you're in a public defender situation, can we carve out an exception to this standard and maybe lower just a little bit for individuals that are representing indigent clients? Is that was the question being asked there?
Well, I think the way I would look at it is the ethical rules are everyone should be abiding by them or should be subject to discipline. And in this case, this attorney had said, hey, before he was looking at a lifetime suspension of his license, so the inability to ever practice law again. I think he was looking for some consideration for having violated the guidelines that he works for the public defender system. We're notoriously underfunded for decades now, to say that don't do this to me. You know what I'm looking at. You know the efforts that the public defender system has made to get funded to make sure that poor clients get a fair shake. And he was told that, if your caseloads are too high, you should have told your supervisor, I won't take anymore, or you should quit. And that was, I think, for my office, a real concern. Not the concern that they need to follow the ethical rules, because I think every attorney in my office wants to do that. But that you could lose your license doing so, that you could lose your livelihood. And I have a number of lawyers in my office who are still paying for their law school and their license.
Right.
And if they lose that, whether they stay with the public defender or not, that's a significant hardship in their lives.
So I've got a quote here from the transcript. It says, in the brief, the respondent mentions that while in hospitalized and suffering from an illness, he continued to work 50 hours a week, that he had the heaviest caseload for the public defenders and more complicated cases. So here we had a guy that was in the hospital, was still working at the time, was still not able to meet these ethical standards that we've talked about, and he's now being subject potentially to discipline on his individual license for that, for not being able to meet the standard.
Right. Well, he's on probation at this time. So he has been disciplined by the Missouri Supreme Court. Office of Disciplinary Counsel.
So I guess my question, Ruth, though, is if we're going to hold attorneys representing indigent clients to the Rule 4 and the various subsets of Rule 4, but we're going to overload these same attorneys with too many cases to make it impossible to meet that standard, then where's the relief valve there? What happens then?
Well, there isn't one. I mean, I have attorneys who work a million hours, but you even working a million hours, you're not going to get... you're not going to get to 122 cases or whatever that number is. What we're asking for is the ability to postpone taking on new cases until we can effectively resolve the clients we have and give them adequate treatment, both as ineffective or as effective assistance of counsel and meeting our obligations under Rule 4.
And so talk to us about this current litigation that's going on. Or it's not current, actually. There's been some decision recently, but I've seen you in the newspaper and I've seen some of the public defenders in the newspaper about this issue.
Right. So, and a number of offices have done this statewide. I can't tell you every office. But what we did is ask the courts to work with us on setting up a postponement list. What postponement does for us is basically says we're not entering on this case. We're not rejecting you. We're not refusing to take your case. But we will take it when we ethically are able to. And when we postpone a case, it gives us the ability to work ethically on the cases we have. And once we're to a level where we can take more cases, take cases off that list. If you're on the list and we haven't entered, the ethical rules aren't applying. I don't have an attorney-client relationship with you where Rule 4 would apply. And it would keep us from being subject to discipline on those cases since we haven't entered and those ethical obligations don't apply.
But so then what about the guy that you've put on the list that's sitting in the county, the jail? So he's going to be sitting there as longer then. So what...
Yes.
Is putting him on that list then, aren't you harming the very people that you've taken an oath to represent?
In a sense, yes. Well, honestly, we're harming them either way. If we bring them in to a lawyer who has 100 cases and isn't going to work on their case for a year, they're harmed. If we bring them into a lawyer who's ready to start working on their case and can perhaps get it resolved in 6 months, time will tell how that works out. The bottom line is we need more attorneys. We need to be funded. If we want timely, competent representation where we're able to do diligence, where we're able to follow competence, we need more lawyers. If I can talk to you about our overload numbers, our trial division, which is statewide, is at a 242% overload. Our appellate division, who is supposed to catch the errors at the trial division misses, is at 280%. We would need, my office alone probably needs 15 more lawyers. And that's just lawyers. That's not even counting support staff. Right now, our offices are looking at a 2 lawyers to 1 support staff ratio. My office, even higher than that, I have 35 lawyers and I have 14 support staff. I have 4 investigators. They are subject to be handling 100 cases apiece, which to investigate 100 cases apiece in a timely manner is just, you can't do it. So to say that we need funding just for lawyers, that would cover the lawyer base. But as far as investigators, we're well outmatched, especially by the prosecutor's office, which has the entirety of the Kansas City Police Department to aid them in investigation.
Again, you're listening to 90.1 KKFI Jaws of Justice. This is a call-in show. If you'd like to give us a question or comment regarding this topic, it's at 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. So, Ruth, what's going on then with this waiting list idea or concept? Has there been litigation regarding it? Or where are we now in Jackson County with regard to your office taking on cases or waitlisting cases?
Well, the judiciary is appointing us despite our request not to. So the judiciary, and I'm not saying all the judiciary because there are a number of individual judges and every judge is making their own decision as far as that goes. But a large number of judges are appointing us anyway. The judge's argument is that there's within Chapter 600, which is the statute that outlines the parameters of the public defender system, there is guidelines about refusing cases and working with the courts on that.
So, but has there been an attempt under Chapter 600 to work with the courts? And let me just read this one, Chapter 600.062, or Section 600.062. It says, acceptance of cases, no authority to limit based on caseload standards. And I don't need to read the rest of it. It pretty much, you know, the title pretty much says it all. What it's suggesting here is the public defender's office as a system does not have the right to limit cases based upon caseload.
Caseload standards. So obviously we've been litigating caseload standards for a long time. When we have a caseload standard that determines those numbers I just discussed about the percentage of overload. The argument I've made to the courts is not caseload standards, although my office is overloaded under caseload standards. The argument I've made is under Rule 4, which I have argued to the courts doesn't fall under Chapter 600. Chapter 600 also has a provision that says you can use other lawful means. There's a lot of limitations under the Chapter 600 standard. One, it looks at the evaluation for whether we're handling our cases well is ineffective assistance of counsel, which is what we discussed earlier, which is the Strickland v. Washington, which we discussed as a very low standard.
Right.
In addition, I'm allowed to say one or more lawyers in my office is overloaded, but not all of them. And obviously that if I had five lawyers overloaded and 25 not overloaded, I would then start giving cases to the other 25. I don't know how we would get relief under that standard. Not to mention that ineffective assistance of counsel is retrospective. It's not necessarily meant to look at caseloads at this time. However, my argument has been it is a Rule 4 issue for us, that we're caught in this catch-22 of I'm competent when I try the case. I just violate all kinds of ethical rules to get there.
Wow. And so, and by the way, the one of the things I see in this Chapter 600, this rule about going to the court and saying, you know, this individual attorney is overloaded, is there seems to be a provision to appoint private counsel in there, but it looks to me like they don't pay the private counsel. Is that?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Right.
And I think it wasn't that part of the problem that probably was around at the time the public defender system was created, was that you had these random attorneys, if you will, taking on cases that a lot of them had no desire or no experience in taking criminal cases.
That's my understanding. My understanding is the whole initiation of the public defender system as a grouping was that it was more cost effective than paying private counsel to take cases, that you weren't giving private counsel cases. In addition, private counsel has the right to refuse cases under Rule 4. They have the right to say that it's a conflict for me because I already am representing too many people and taking on these free cases or these appointment cases is going to be a hardship for me.
Again, if any callers have any comments or questions regarding this topic, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. So just to make sure I understand, Ruth, again, we're talking about you talked about a catch-22 situation. On the floor, if you will, there's the ineffective assistance of counsel standard. And I can tell you that having just been involved in a case regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, I think it was recently litigated this year, 2017. And if I remember right, the trial itself happened in 2011. So 6 years after the trial, we're now getting to the point of litigating ineffective assistance of counsel, which is this delay you're talking about. It doesn't really speak to right now. And in addition, the standard is so low. And the reason I say that is we know that because very few, if any, cases are overturned based on ineffective assistance of counsel. That's the floor. Is that right so far?
Yes.
So we have a floor that's very low, and we have it, it's retrospective, and we don't get to it for a number of years anyway. And then what you're saying is, all right, that's the floor, but what we're looking to is we're looking to the standard that we are told we must meet, which is a Rule 4 standard for how attorneys should behave and how they should engage with their client and engage with the representation. Is that right?
Right.
And so if you're going to make us do that, all right, but give us an impossible caseload or make it impossible for us to meet it, you're going to demand we meet it, but then make it impossible that we meet it, then something's got to give. And what's going to give is we're going to have to tell these individuals, hey, we'll take your case, but not right now. We're going to put you on a wait list. Is that?
Yeah. I call it a postponement list. Yes.
The postponement. We do have a caller. Caller, you're on the line. What is your name and what part of town are you calling from?
Hi, my name's Elisa Breitenbach, and I'm calling from Raytown, Missouri. I actually once went through a criminal trial and was declared indigent and had to go to court with court-appointed counsel. I had very fortunate luck, but honestly, it takes a miracle to do anything in the court of law. I was able to prove with one attorney that I did have ineffective counsel, but honestly, it's just because I had a judge that truly was incredible. It's incompetent for any judge to think that any attorney in this country could do these cases with such a short amount of time. It's just completely incompetent. My attorney was exhausted when she got done with my case. I mean, she about collapsed in the courtroom. It was so horrible. I so commend what you guys do in your office, and I just hope you guys get the funding that you so desperately need, because, you know, people deserve a good attorney that can devote the time that they need to this, and there's no way anyone can dedicate any kind of time at all when you have 100 cases. It's incompetent to think that anybody could. So thank you for your hard work, and I pray you get your money that you so desperately need to fund this.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your call. We have another caller on the phone. I think we saw one more caller on the phone. Oh, we don't have another caller on the phone. Thank you very much for your comment. This ability, I had a question from someone off there, the ability to appoint counsel in these cases. It says this is 600.064, and if you want to, just go to Google and type in RSMO 600.064. Before a circuit judge appoints private counsel, the judge shall investigate the defendant's financial status to verify the defendant does not have means to obtain counsel. By the way, if I bond out of jail, what does my bond have to be below in order to avoid being, I guess, rich or avoid having being deemed able to hire counsel?
Well, we don't. Historically, we had a threshold of a $5,000 bond. We no longer have that threshold. It's a matter of making argument and taking the client.
So $5,000, that was $5,000 10%. So if I posted $500 before, I was deemed not indigent.
Yes, there were years when there was a bright line threshold. That no longer is.
Okay. But I assume that it's a pretty low threshold still with regard. Let me rephrase that. You have to be pretty damn indigent to be indigent in order to get a public defender.
Yes, most of our clients are extremely poor.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Caller, please state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Daniel, and I'm calling from Grandview.
Yes, Daniel, what's your comment?
Well, it seems like the governor's office ought to be interested in this, and that the answer could lie in the legislature. It's a problem. I mean, is there some way that the office, that these lawyers could strike or all quit as a form of protest? I mean, there ought to be a message going out to the public about this issue.
Ruth, go ahead.
Well, at present, the public defender's office is not unionized. And as far as quit, That's a hard thing to look at. Definitely, I've had people mention the desire. And my office turns over at a rate of 25 to 30% a year anyway, so we're constantly hiring, training along those lines. The problem is most of the lawyers that work for me are not working because they get paid well, because they don't. They're working there because they really want poor people to have a fair shake in the system. And a lot of them would see that as really abandoning the clients. Nobody in my office, no one's there because they don't want to work. They want to represent the clients, and they want to make sure that they get treated like any other client in the criminal justice system. However, that's a pretty rough thing to do. Although I understand the sentiment, and I won't say that it wasn't bandied about in the office on several occasions.
So thank you very much for your caller We have time for one more 30-second call. Caller, state your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, my name is JR, and I'm calling from a competent hospital.
All right. What's your question or comment? Again, we only have a few more seconds left before we have to end our show.
My question is, I've been hung up in the system now for almost since 2015, and I still haven't went to trial. I paid an attorney, and he walked off trial and said I was incompetent, and he walked with my money. So now they put me a public defender, and I haven't heard from her for almost 7 months. So I'm wanting to know, who can I contact? I'm a faithful listener to your station. I love it. But who can I contact to talk about this problem for future reference?
Thank you, caller, for your call. Ruth, go ahead. If there's some number to give out, please do so, and then we'll close it down here in a second.
Well, every attorney in the system has a supervisor. I know I'm a supervisor at my office, so I would call and ask for the supervisor at the office of the lawyer you're at. Unfortunately, client contact, as we mentioned, is one of the things that suffers with an excessive caseload, and usually talking to a supervisor can help you with that. And I wish you the best of luck with your case, sir.
Thank you. So, Ruth, we're coming now to a little bit of the end of the show, and I thank you. This is one of those topics that really requires a lot more time, but we don't have that today. But hopefully we can have you back for another one. Any closing thoughts for our listener, perhaps where you would like to see this current crisis, how you'd like to see it resolve itself?
Well, obviously, I'd like to see our system funded. I'd like to have the correct number of lawyers to handle the caseload. If in the immediate, obviously, that's, there's going to have to be a budget submitted, and the legislature will have to pass it. The governor would have to sign it for all of that to happen. And that's not going to happen anytime soon. I would like to see controls put in place that my attorneys aren't putting their careers, their licenses in jeopardy.
Great. Ruth, thank you so much for being on our show. We hope to have you back again in the near future. And you're listening to David Bell on Jaws of Justice, 90.1 KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. When I was in Atlanta, I got a chance to speak to Jeff Malansky at the Drug Policy Alliance conference.
One thing that lies at the heart of why you're here is your, truthfully, life experience. Talk about what happened to you as a young man.
How true. I, of course, used cannabis when I was younger. And I had, in Missouri, I ended up getting a life sentence, or I should say a life without sentence. In other words, I was supposed to die in prison. Fortunately, people got together and signed petitions and sent them to our governor. And new approach, show me cannabis. And a lot of people out there, press, got together and kept calling the governor and finally got a computation. Now, I'm still on parole, but at least I'm out.
No, I was one of those, I wouldn't dare say few in the media, that was giving your story attention and the respect it deserved.
Well, that was fantastic, because if it wasn't for the media, none of it would have happened whatsoever, because, like I say, information is the key, and how else are we going to get it out to the people so that people actually know what's going on? And what's really so sad is we still have over 3,000 men and women in prison, federal and state, right now doing life without for nonviolent crimes. That's a shame.
It is truly a shame, and a stain, if you ask me, on our criminal justice system. Jeff, I see you setting a table out here at this convention, Drug Policy Alliance folk. What information are you sharing specifically this time around?
Well, we're trying to share the idea of what's going on with the people in prison, of course, what we can do to help to try to get them out, legalization efforts, and we're getting ready to show a movie called Lifers, and it's about me and other people that have had life sentences that have been in trouble with the law over cannabis, unfortunately, and shows why it's such a crime to be locking up people for a plant.
Well, Jeff, I just sense a change is afoot. People are beginning to recognize the hypocrisy of it all. We have cops stealing drugs from evidence rooms and selling it on the streets, getting minuscule sentences in comparison to what you were subjected to and what thousands of people are subjected to every year here in these United States.
Life without parole, 23 years behind bars for marijuana. We got to end this madness. I am Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.